I hope to finish up the section on debt in this series today. I do have several things I'd like to talk about regarding debt, maybe even get past it, I'm not sure. So just give you an overview of where I intend to go. I want to talk about how Christians should be lenders and not borrowers, and the Bible teaches this. I'll give you some verses for that. We're going to look at how being in debt is a curse, and it's a judgment from God. I want to impress upon you the necessity of avoiding and hating debt. That's really the only way you're going to get out of it and not get into it, is if you hate it. I want to encourage you to pay your debts if you have them. We want to talk about contentment, which is the antidote to debt. And I want to talk about keeping up with the Joneses briefly. And then I want to end talking about debt with an exhortation about covetousness, which is the cause of debt. So covetousness is the cause, contentment is the antidote for debt. And then maybe get on to some other topics of gambling and bankruptcy. I don't know if I'll get to that or not. But gambling and bankruptcy are two separate topics, but the latter will result from the former if you're not very careful with it. Okay, so let's first of all turn to Deuteronomy 15 and verse 6, which is why I read this passage before the sermon today. And here we see that Christians should be lenders, not borrowers. And sadly, this is rarely the case today. I don't know what the statistics are. I should have looked it up, but I didn't think about it until this morning. But if I had to guess, I would guess it's kind of like divorce. When you look at Christian and heathen alike, there's probably absolutely no difference. 50% divorce rate, Christians and heathen, roughly. And my guess is most heathen and most Christians are in debt up to their eyeballs. That's just the way the world is. And that's sad. That's sad. There should be a big difference between the two. Deuteronomy 15 and verse 6. It says, "For the Lord thy God blesseth thee, as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow. And thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee." So if Israel was being obedient to the Lord and under the Lord's blessing, God would bless them and they would be lenders. They would lend to many nations. They wouldn't borrow from any. They would rule and reign over many nations. They wouldn't be subject to them. Now, what is true of the nation is also true of the individual. If you're blessed of God, you're going to be a lender, not a borrower. You're not going to be under servitude. And what does this verse say about our nation today? Is our nation blessed? Is our nation cursed? Are we a lender or a borrower nation? We used to be a lender. We used to be the wealthiest nation in the world. We lended to other nations. We produced most of what the rest of the world consumed, especially after World War II. But that's changed. We are now the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. Almost $37 trillion in debt. It's strange. We're rich and poor at the same time. We have incredible wealth and still incredible production, really. But yet we're the largest debtor nation. We're in debt up to our eyeballs. Which will result in the second half of that verse eventually. When he says, "Thou shalt reign over many nations, and they shall not reign over thee," well, guess what? When the opposite is true, when you're a borrower nation, nations reign over you. The borrower is servant to the lender. And that's coming. But I'm really concerned about you individually. What the government does, what Uncle Sam does, is far less concerning to me than what you do. I remember a while back I preached a sermon. I don't remember what the title of it was. Anyway, but I made the point there that your own personal financial situation is far more dangerous for you than anything that is going on out there, that the government's doing, that the president's doing, that the World Economic Forum's doing, or the Bilderbergers, or the CFR, or the Masons, or the Illuminati, or whatever. Your personal financial situation is far more dangerous to you than anything any of the rest of these people are doing. Now, Christians who hearken diligently unto God and keep his commandments will be blessed by God to be lenders and not borrowers. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 28. We're going to look at verses 1 and 2, which is the preamble to all these blessings that the Lord promised Israel. And then we're going to look at one of those blessings in verse 12. Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 2. And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. So again, they would be blessed as a nation, and they would be above all nations if they obeyed the Lord. Getting back to our nation, why do you think we are no longer blessed? Why are we in debt up to our eyeballs as a nation? Well, it's because we've turned our back on the Lord's commandments. Starting a long, long time ago, but especially ramping up in the 1960s, right, and beyond. And when did our nation start to go deep into debt? Around the same time, 50s and 60s, our nation went into debt big time, and it's just been no turning back from that point. At the same time that moral decadence started in this nation at a warp speed. These two things are not unrelated. But let's look down at verse 12. Here's one of the blessings to people who keep God's commandments. The Lord shall open unto thee his good treasure, the heaven, to give the rain unto thy land in his season, and to bless all the work of thine hand. And thou shalt lend unto many nations, and thou shalt not borrow. So when a nation's blessed, they're lenders. That means that they have worked and produced much, they've underconsumed, they've saved, and now they have money to lend. They're not debtors. They're the bankers, they're not the servants. That's what happens to a godly nation. They will be the head and not the tail. Verse 13. And the Lord shall make thee the head, and not the tail. And thou shalt be above only, and thou shalt not be beneath. If thou hearken unto the commandment of the Lord thy God, which I command thee this day to observe and to do it. So a nation that's blessed is the head, not the tail. Now, I have a question for you. This is an anatomical question for you. Where is the tail close to on an animal? Right? What does that tell you about a debtor who is the tail and not the head? What does that tell you about what God thinks about being in debt? I'm not going to say the word that comes to mind, but the word that comes to mind that's next to the tail, you probably have a good idea. Not a good thing. Now, he says that you'll be the head. If you are obeying the Lord and you're blessed of the Lord, you're going to be the head, right? What's in the head? The brain, right? The brain's in the head. And those that use it instead of their hearts will avoid debt. If you use your brain, if you use your logical thinking, you won't go into debt. Because you're going to be like, wait a minute, why in the world would I borrow money to buy something and then pay a mountain of interest and end up paying way more, maybe even two or three times as much for the same item? Why wouldn't I just wait, be a little bit content, have a little bit of patience, and buy the thing with cash, and it'll save me a ton of money, and I won't be a servant to anybody? See, if you're using your brain, you don't go into debt. If you're using your heart, your emotions, in other words, your heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, you know what you do? Whatever feels good. I want it. I don't have the money, I'll just sign on the line. I'll swipe the card, right? So when you're the head, you use your head. You don't go into debt. When you're the you-know-what, you use your heart, and you start going into debt. And maybe I just completely made up a big interpretation of this verse, but it sounded good to me anyway. So what is being a lender say about a Christian then? Being a lender says that he's blessed, right? He's blessed by God. He is ahead in life. Why do I say he's ahead in life? Think about a dog walking down the sidewalk. Is his head ahead of his tail, or is it behind? Right? His head is ahead. Right? So he is getting ahead in life because he's the head. He's not the tail. He's not behind in life. He's smart. He's using his head. Right? He's not butt dumb, as Conrad used to say. Not using his tail. Now, being a debtor, on the other hand, is to be cursed and under the judgment of God. Let's look at Deuteronomy 28 and verse 15. Verse 15, the Lord now introduces the curses. In this chapter, it's blessings and curses. He gives the blessings first, and then he gives the curses. And if you'll notice, the curses are a lot longer. There's a lot more negative stuff than positive stuff in the Bible. I don't know if you noticed that or not. You just go through the Bible and look at how many times it says not. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Right? Not, not, not. Thou shalt not. I'm not the negative one here. I'm just preaching the word. And maybe I'm negative too. Maybe it's a double negative, and that would be a positive, wouldn't it, if it's a double negative. So anyway, you should be happy that you're getting a positive sermon today. Verse 15. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Now let's go down to verse 44. Here's one of the curses. He shall lend to thee, this is the stranger. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. See, if you're under God's curse, if you haven't kept his commandments, now things are flipped around. Now instead of being the head, you're the tail. Now instead of being the lender, you're the borrower. What does it say about a Christian then who is in debt? Well, he's cursed, right? We just saw that. That's one of the curses. He's cursed. He's under God's judgment. He's behind in life because he's the tail, right? You get it? He's behind. He's not getting ahead. He's not using his head because he's the tail. Right? That's why he's going into debt. Getting further and further behind as life goes on. And you don't want to be there. Now, Christians should avoid and hate debt. And hating debt is the only way that you're ever going to get out of it. If you don't hate it, you're probably just going to stay in it the rest of your life. If you don't like it, you may have a little less of it, but you're never going to get out of it and stay out of it unless you have a holy hatred for debt. And this goes with anything else. You are probably never going to lose weight and keep it off unless you have a holy hatred for obesity. You're just like, I am done. I am so sick and tired of being fat. I'm not going to be fat anymore. I hate this. And that is the turning point. Or anything else, you name it, in life. Until you really hate it, you're probably not going to change your behavior. If you're ever going to get out of debt and never get back into it again, you have to hate it. If you attempt to get out of debt half-heartedly, like, I'm going to give this a try, I'm going to see, I'm going to try to cut back here a little bit, maybe there a little bit, forget about it. You're not going to get anywhere. You've got to go at it wholeheartedly, or you won't succeed. If you don't, like I said, have a holy hatred for debt, you're going to take on more of it. Because the next thing's going to come up is like, oh, I really need this thing, whatever, I need this, I need that. Right? Most of which you don't actually need. Maybe some of which you do because you haven't been good with money. But then you're going to go back into it because you don't hate it enough. You've got to hate it. Remember that debt is likened unto sin in the Bible. Remember we saw that last Sunday, or the last Sunday that I preached a couple of weeks ago. Debt is likened unto sin, and God tells us that we are to hate every false way which is against his precepts, which includes being in debt. You remember the verses, the borrower is servant to the lender, the foolish man spendeth it up, right? Owe no man anything, be not servants of men, right? All these verses that I've given you over the course of these weeks shows us that being in debt is against God's precepts. Well, you need to hate that false way. Psalm 119 and verse 128. Psalm 119 and verse 128. Therefore I esteem all thy precepts, concerning all things to be right, and I hate every false way. All thy precepts concerning all things, that includes being in debt. That includes money management. I esteem everything that God says about money management to be right, which God says, don't overspend, foolish man spendeth it up. God says, save, there's treasure to be desired, and oil in the dwelling of the wise, right? God says, don't be in debt, the borrower servant to the lender. This is like Dave Ramsey says, he didn't come up with anything novel, this is just what God and grandma have always taught, right? You esteem all those things to be right, and you hate every false way. Hate credit card debt, hate car loans, hate personal loans, hate student loans, hate all this stuff, right? Hate it. That's the only way. Psalm 97 and verse 10. Love and hate are two sides of the same coin in a way. Because if you love truth, you're going to hate lies. If you love righteousness, you're going to hate sin. If you love the Lord, you're going to hate evil. That's what this verse says. Psalm 97 and verse 10. Ye that love the Lord, hate evil. He preserveth the souls of his saints. He delivereth them out of the hand of the wicked. How many people hate the big banksters that make all this money, right? That are, half of them have paid out, I'm not going to say half, some of them have paid out billions of dollars in fines because of all their corruption in these big banks like J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo and some of those ones. They hate the big banks, but they have just no problem with all the suckers that take all the loans from the big banks. You realize the big banks couldn't be screwing people. The big banks can be doing all this stuff if there weren't a bunch of suckers out there taking all the money from them. Think about that. Ye that love the Lord, hate evil. You want to avoid debt. Pass not by it. Turn from it and pass away. You probably know where I'm going, maybe. Proverbs chapter 4, verses 14 through 15. Proverbs 4, 14 through 15. Again, this verse is just general, but you can make it specific. You can take this verse and you can apply it to this topic very easily. Enter not into the path of the wicked. The path of the wicked is doing things that God says don't do, like taking on excessive debt, for instance. Enter not into the path of the wicked. Go not in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Avoid debt. Pass not by it. Don't even get close to it. Turn from it. If you end up there, go the other direction and pass away. Stay away from it. When you get a credit card offer in the mail, throw it away. Don't even open it. I get those stupid things in the mail. Throw them away. Don't even open them. I'm not tempted by it, thankfully. That's not one of my temptations. But if you are, throw it away. Don't even look at it. Don't think, oh, well, I could pay off my current credit card with this new card, and I don't have to make any payments for X amount of months, and it's 0% interest. And then when I get to the end of that one, then I can just put it on a different card, and I can just keep not paying all this debt and have zero interest. Don't do that. Quit being stupid. Pay the dumb thing off. Pay it off. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it and pass away. Get away from it. Next time some fool tries to tell you to take out a car loan, tell him to go jump in a lake. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it and pass away. Purpose in your heart that you won't transgress God's commandments concerning debt. Let's look at Psalm 17, 3 through 4. Am I getting my point across? Am I clear? Is this ambiguous at all? I hope you don't walk away thinking, I don't really understand. I'm not sure what Pastor Wagner thinks about debt. He's kind of wishy-washy about it. I hope that that's not what you go away with. I hope you go away and you know what? I am absolutely certain of one thing, that Pastor Wagner hates debt. If you're not certain of anything else, you can be certain of that. Psalm 17, 3 through 4. Thou hast proved mine heart. Thou hast visited me in the night. Thou hast tried me and shalt find nothing. I am purposed that my mouth shall not transgress. And you know what? You should also be purposed that your wallet shall not transgress as well. And every other area of your life shall not transgress. Purpose in your heart that you won't transgress regarding finances. concerning the works of men, by the word of thy lips, I have kept me from the paths of the destroyer. The paths of the destroyer, in what I'm talking about, would be the paths of the debt makers, of the bankers, of the credit card companies. All the people that are trying to manipulate you with all of their clever marketing to go into debt. Stay away from the paths of the destroyer. Those people destroy homes. They destroy lives. Now, if you do have debt, you ought to pay it. Christians ought to pay our debts. It is the wicked who borrow and don't pay it back. Psalm 37 and verse 21. Psalm 37, 21. I'll talk about bankruptcy later. It'll probably be next Sunday. But if you have debt, you ought to pay it off. The idea that I have debt and I'm just going to declare bankruptcy and just get it all wiped clean is unchristian. It's unchristian. It's unbiblical. But I'll prove that later. Psalm 37 and verse 21. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. See, wicked people have no problem borrowing money and not paying it back. Right? They do it all the time. Especially when it comes to places that aren't banks and other institutions that would have legal power over them to send in debt collectors and to really make their life miserable or garnish their wages or whatever. When they owe money to people that don't have that kind of power, like your brother or your sister or your mother or father or children or friends or whatever, then there's a lot of people that don't bother repaying debt because, whatever. That's just what they think. That's a wicked mindset. If you owe anybody anything, you ought to pay it. You don't want to tell somebody that you can't repay him if you have the money and you could repay him. Or if you have stuff that you could sell and repay him. That is not right. Let's look at Proverbs 3 and verse 28. Proverbs 3 and verse 28. You know, if you're driving around in a big old Suburban and you owe somebody $1,000 and you're like, oh, sorry, I'm broke, I can't. Oh, yeah, you can. Sell the stupid Suburban, pay your debt. Proverbs 3 and verse 28. Say not unto thy neighbor, go and come again, and tomorrow I will give thee, when thou hast it by thee. The Lord here is telling you, don't even wait another day. If you've got the money, pay it now. Pay it today. Now, Ramsey recommends, I know I talk about Ramsey a lot, but I think sometimes if you hear it from somebody else, if you keep hearing it from me, then you think, oh, this is just the rantings of a crazy preacher. But if I bring up some national figure, maybe that'll help. I don't know. But Ramsey recommends, if you're in debt, if you've got credit card debt or any kind of debt, except for your mortgage, if you have any kind of debt and you have savings, you take that savings, except for $1,000, and you put it all in the debt. So if you've got $10,000 in savings, and you've got $15,000 in credit card debt, $9,000 of that savings goes on the credit card debt. You've got $6,000 left of debt now, and you've got $1,000 to your name, and you get busy. And you start paying that thing off as fast as you possibly can, using the debt snowball method, which I'll get to later, which I've mentioned already. Go smallest to largest. I mean, and you go medieval on that debt. You go scorched earth on that debt. Like Ramsey says, you don't see the inside. Well, you're in debt, you don't see the inside of a restaurant unless you're working in one. Now that honestly would make me very, very fearful, honestly, to spend my savings down to $1,000. Some people are like, man, I wish I had $1,000 in savings. I'd be feeling like I was king of the hill. If I spent my savings down to $1,000, I'd be a mess. That doesn't work with me at all. But I think he's wise to tell people to do that, because that gets you in a mindset. When you pay that down and you've only got $1,000 in your savings account and your mini emergency fund, your back is now to the wall. There is no goofing around anymore. You're $1,000 between you and financial ruin. And then it's get busy and pay that thing off as fast as you possibly can and then build that emergency fund back up. That's what he recommends. And I think it makes sense. Because otherwise, what's the sense? You got $10,000 sitting in a bank account. You got $15,000 in credit card debt. Your $10,000 making you what? 1%? If you have it in a high yield savings account, maybe it's making you close to 4%. And your credit card's at what? 22, 25, 28%? Stupidest thing in the world. Right? Take the savings, pay off the credit card, and get your act together and get that thing paid off and start saving that money back up again. You owe the money, pay it. And if a Christian does borrow money, he should keep his word and pay it back according to the terms of the loan. So whatever the terms of the loan are, pay it back. Now, if you have secured debt, like a house or a car or something, and there's actually collateral for the debt, like credit card debt is unsecured, right? There's no collateral. But if you have secured debt, like for a house, for instance, and you lose your job and you can't make the payments on the house anymore, and the terms of the loan are, if you don't pay this, the bank takes the house. Okay. I mean, you didn't break the contract. They just take the house, right? It's not a good position to be in at all, but you're not like some kind of a contract breaker in that case. They just repossess the house. But you definitely want to do whatever you can to avoid that. That's not a good situation, clearly. Okay, now let's talk about contentment. Like I said, this is the antidote to being in debt. Now, this is going to hurt, probably, but I'm going to say it anyway. A person that finances something is an impatient and a discontent person. That's a fact. If you finance something, you are, except for a house, I would say, because, you know, that's almost necessary for most people these days to have some kind of a loan for a house. But other than that, there's no reason to take out a loan for anything else in your life ever. Period. Ever. Nothing. Cars, education, furniture, nothing. Never any reason to ever take out a loan for anything. I cannot be any clearer, I don't think. If you finance anything beside the house, you're impatient and discontent. You can't wait. That's what it is to be impatient. And you're not happy with what you have. That's what it is to be discontent. Content is having one's desires bounded by what one has. This is Oxford English Dictionary definition. Having one's desires bounded by what one has, though that may be less than one could have wished. Not disturbed by the desire of anything more or of anything different. Satisfied so as not to repine. Easy though not highly pleased. In the imperative, like in the statement, be content, it means be satisfied in mind, be calm, quiet, not uneasy. Now, this definition is very interesting. It's having one's desires bounded by what one has, though it may be less than one would have wished. Right? So it's not that I'm content because I have everything that I want. No. You can be content when you don't have everything you want. That's the whole idea. Right? You want other things. You want more than you have, but yet you can be satisfied with what you actually have. That is contentment. Not disturbed by the desire of anything more or anything different. So you have a desire for something more, but you're not disturbed by it. You're like, yeah, it'd be nice. I'd like to have a new car, but I don't have the money in my bank account, so therefore I'm not getting the new car. I'm going to drive my old car. I'd like to have a bigger house, but I don't have the money to pay for it. So I'm going to wait, and I'm going to save, right? Whatever it might be. I'd like to go back to college and get a master's degree, which is probably the dumbest thing you'd ever do in your entire life in almost like 90% of some circumstances. But I want to do that, but I don't have the money. So therefore, I'm content. I'm not going to let that desire for higher education, so-called, bother me. That's what contentment is. My couch looks like a piece of garbage. It's got holes all through it. It's threadbare, and I'd like to have another one, but I don't have the money. Therefore, I'm going to be happy with what I have, and I'm going to save up money and buy one, right? That's contentment. A content person is happy with what he has. I am not content with that line in the outline, though, because it says a content person is happy with what his has. I'm not content with that. That's a typo. Let me get my pen out and fix that. Let's look at Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Hebrews 13 and verse 5, we're going to see that the Bible shows that this definition from Oxford is spot on. Hebrews 13 and verse 5, let your conversation, your manner of life, be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee, nor forsake thee. I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So be content with what you have. Maybe you don't live in the best neighborhood. Maybe you live in a place that you'd really not want to live. Well, you know what? Be content with such things as you have. The Lord won't leave you or forsake you. He's not going to leave you high and dry. Maybe you're concerned that your old car is going to break down. It'd be really nice to have a new one. But guess what? Be content with such things as you have. The Lord will never leave you nor forsake thee on the side of the road. That's what he says. Don't worry about it. Save up money and buy stuff. A discontent person is not happy with what he has and borrows money that he doesn't have to buy something he wants and probably doesn't need. That's what happens. Discontent, not happy with what he has, borrows money, buys something that he wants that he probably doesn't need. And usually most things that people borrow money for, they don't need. These are wants. They're not needs. Very few things do people borrow money for that are actually needs. And if you do borrow money for needs, it's because you were not content with things in the past and you spent all your money. Now you're actually borrowing money for needs, right? If you had been good with money, you would never be borrowing money for needs. Contentment is a learned thing. It doesn't come naturally. Let's look at Philippians 4, 11 through 12. Been over this verse before. I've been over this verse in this series, I think, and I've preached a couple of sermons on this verse back in Minneapolis. I remember that. But this is really important. It's good to go over it again. Philippians 4 and verses 11 and 12. Contentment is learned. Philippians 4, 11. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. See, this is learned. I've learned to be content in whatsoever state I am. Wherever Paul was, whatever his situation, he learned to be content right there. Even when he was sitting in a prison cell. And you know where he was sitting when he wrote this letter? In a prison cell. This is one of the prison epistles. He talks about his bonds in this very book. So he's sitting in prison and he says, I've learned to be content in whatever state I am. Think about that. That'd be hard to be content in a first century prison. It'd be hard to be content in any prison. But Paul had learned to do so. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed, both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. So contentment is learned. So I say start practicing. Because you're not going to learn it if you don't practice. Have you ever seen anybody sit down at a piano for the first time and start playing a beautiful piece? No. Why? Because he or she hasn't practiced. And the same goes for everything else. Anything you're going to learn, you've got to practice. Start practicing. I've been practicing contentment for a long, long time. I lived in an apartment, still do, have lived in apartments for 17 years while saving for a house. That took some learning. Learning to be content in a not optimal housing situation for 17 years of my life. I've driven old, cheap, in some cases real clunker cars for my whole life. I've been content with that. Yes, would I have liked a better one? Of course. But, you know, I'd rather not spend another 5 years in an apartment wasting money on cars so I can buy a house, right? I paid cash for everything I have ever bought. That takes contentment. Saving up the money, buying it with cash, or just not buying it, period. So I've worked on this contentment thing. And it hasn't been easy. I don't know if you realize it or not, but I do not have an angelic nature. Did you know that? Did you realize that? That I'm just like, just exactly like every one of you? Did you know that? When a man is ordained, he does not change into something different. I am just exactly like you. I've got all the same desires, all the same temptations. I am just exactly like you. You know that, right? I've had to learn contentment just like everybody else. I'm no different. I may be weird. I may be strange. I may be a little different as far as that goes. But as far as my nature goes, I'm no different than anybody else. Let me give you a couple of quotes here from Ramsey. This is from his book, The Total Money Makeover. He says, "It is human nature to want it and want it now. It is also a sign of immaturity. Being willing to delay pleasure for a greater result is a sign of maturity. However, our culture teaches us to live for the now. I want it," we scream. And we can get it if we're willing to go into debt. Debt is a means to obtain the I want it before we can afford them. That statement that he made there when I read the book for the first time, when he talked about it's a sign of immaturity to go into debt, to buy things that you can't afford. It's a sign of maturity to deny yourself. And that really hit home with me. I thought that is the definition of maturity, is delayed gratification, because children don't delay gratification at all, ever, unless they're forced to. It's a sign of maturity to delay gratification, to wait. In his other book, or one of his other books, Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money, he said this, "You know what I've discovered? Every one of us has a little, spoiled, red-faced grocery store kid living inside of us. His name is immaturity, and he wakes up when we're shopping. At the electronics store, he wants a big screen TV. At the outdoors store, he wants a bass boat. At the car lot, he wants a convertible. At the furniture store, he wants a new leather sofa. If we let that kid make our financial decisions, we'll always be broke. Children do what feels good. Adults devise a plan and follow it." That's powerful, I think. Very good. Every one of us has that. Myself included. Every one of us goes someplace and is like, oh man, I'd really like to have that. I really want that. The mature man says, nope, can't afford it. Or even if he could afford it, he often says no anyway. No, that's not a good use of my money. That's a waste of money. The immature person says, I can't afford it. Give me that pen. Let me sign on that line. I'll pay on it for the rest of my life. Or for a bunch of more years or whatever. Let me read you a few wise words about contentment. I thought some of these are good. These are just quotes that some of which I've collected over the years, some of which I found more recently. Brentius said the following, "He is rich, not who possesses much, but who desires little." Think about that. He is rich, not who possesses much, but who desires little. I made this point years and years ago. I remember this pretty vividly. If your desires are small and you're content with what you have, you're basically just as rich in practice as the wealthiest billionaire in this country. Because if you think about it, Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or whoever, those men can have anything they want. And they probably do have everything they want. There's nothing that they want that they can't have as far as physical possessions go. But guess what? You can be middle class, lower middle class. You could even be poor. And if you have few desires and you're just happy with your little meager life, and you don't want anything else, and you have everything that you desire, you already have, you're just like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos. They each have everything that they want, and you have everything that you want. Right? So if you limit your desires, you're rich. You're rich. Especially if you define richness as having everything you want. Right? Think about it. If being rich is having everything you want, you can be rich just by not wanting very many things. It's true. Matthew Henry said, "Nature is content with little, grace with less, but lust with nothing." He was such a clever writer. Did you get what he's saying there? Nature is content with little, grace with less, but lust with nothing. Like, nothing is going to satisfy lust. Lust just wants more and more and more and more. H. Jackson Brown Jr. in his book, Life's Little Instruction Book, said, or wrote, "Be happy with what you have while working for what you want." You know what he's saying? Be content. Be content. That's exactly the definition of contentment. You're satisfied with what you have, though you desire to have more, but you're okay with what you have. And that's I think that's such a good life lesson right there. Be happy with what you want while working, or with what you have while working for what you want. In other words, work, save, and pay for things in due time. Philip Keller, in his great book, A Shepherd Looks at Psalm 23. I read this one within the last year or so. Great book. He said the following. These really jumped out at me, and I underlined them, and then I remembered it and put them in the outline. "One of the outstanding marks of a Christian should be a serene sense of gentle contentment." He continues, "As the children of God, the sheep in the divine shepherd's care, we should be known as the most contented people on earth. A quiet, restful contentment should be the hallmark of those who call Christ their master." All right, now let's look at the opposite of contentment. Well, the opposite's really covetousness. We'll get there in a second. But let's look at the opposite of content people, and that is the Joneses, okay? Keeping up with the Joneses. I shouldn't say the Joneses aren't content. I mean, maybe technically the Joneses could be, but the people that are trying to keep up with them aren't. You've, of course, heard the phrase, keeping up with the Joneses. Many people today are in debt because they want to look impressive to their friends, family, and neighbors. That's why a lot of people are in debt. They want to look good. They want to have the nice house that looks good. They want everybody to look at it and ooh and ah. They want to have the nice, fancy new car because people look at it and think, wow, this guy's doing well. Except if you're me and I look at it and say, wow, this guy's got a pile of debt, probably. That's why, though, a lot of people go into debt. They want to impress others. Why do you think people wear Rolex watches? I mean, you got to have some money to wear one of those things. I don't know, they're many, many thousands, 10, 20,000, I don't know what they are. But why do people wear Rolexes? Because they tell time better than other watches? Of course not, right? They probably want to look impressive. Is it just because it's just a neat watch, or do they always wear the cufflinks so the watch always sticks out? You know, make sure everybody sees it. This isn't a Rolex. This is a Casio. Okay, it's almost like a Rolex. It's just a little bit. It's like $20,000 cheaper. But other than that, it's pretty much just like a Rolex. Here's what Ramsey said in A Total Money Makeover. He said, "We buy things we don't need with money we don't have in order to impress people we don't like." I love that. Let me read it again. "We buy things we don't need with money we don't have in order to impress people we don't like." That is so true. How many people do that? They got some ex-girlfriend that they're still bitter at, and so they go out and buy a really big, expensive, huge truck so they can drive around so she's going to see how well I'm doing, right? I'm going to impress somebody I don't even like. Just as an example. He also wrote, "One of the paradoxical dumb things we do is to destroy our finances by buying garbage we can't afford to try to make ourselves appear wealthy to others." I like Ramsey. He doesn't mince words. "Don't even consider," he continues, "don't even consider keeping up with the Joneses. They're broke. Remember, if the Joneses, all the broke people, think you're cool, You are heading the wrong way. If they think you're crazy, you are probably on track. Very true. So I say train yourself to stop thinking that people who drive new expensive cars, live in nice expensive houses, wear expensive clothes, have lots of toys, take nice vacations. Train yourself to stop thinking that those people have money and instead realize that they are most likely in debt and broke. That's the truth. Chances are, as I've mentioned in this study before, you wouldn't recognize a millionaire if you saw one. Let me give you a quote here. This is from Ramsey again in Total Money Makeover. He says, in his study of millionaires, Stanley's the one that wrote The Millionaire Next Door that I've quoted from extensively in this series. Stanley discovered that their habits and value systems were not what most people think. When we think of millionaires, we think of big houses, new cars, and really nice clothes. Stanley found that most millionaires don't have those things. He found the typical millionaire lives in a middle-class home, drives a 2-year-old or older paid-for car, and buys blue jeans at Walmart. In short, Stanley found that the typical millionaire found infinitely more motivation from the goal of financial security than from what friends and family thought. The need for approval and respect from others based on what they owned was virtually non-existent. And that's why they're millionaires. Because they don't care what other people think. They don't care what their family or friends or coworkers or anybody else thinks. They don't care if they're driving the junker and people look at them and think that they're not doing well. They probably just kind of smile inside and think, yep, that guy thinks I'm broke. That's kind of funny. That's kind of cool. But I'm a millionaire, right? That's probably what they think. Like, if he could, they probably have this little smile on their head. If they could only see my bank account. Yeah, I'm driving this old clunker, but if they could only see my bank account, that's probably what they think. I don't know. I'm not in their head, but I can just imagine. Or maybe they don't even think about that at all. Maybe they just don't even care at all. Like, it doesn't even ever cross their mind. So we need to stop equating looking wealthy with being wealthy. Because everybody looks wealthy in America. Very few actually are. All right, now let's look at the root of indebtedness, and that is covetousness. Covetousness is the opposite of contentment. Let's look at Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Again, we read this verse, but I want to read it again and draw your attention to this part of it. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. You see the contrast there? Be without covetousness and be content. Right? You can't be both. There's no such thing as a covetous, content person. It's impossible. You're either one or the other. Covetousness is strong or inordinate desire. Covetous is having an ardent or excessive desire for, a desire of, or for anything, eagerly desirous to do, have, or be. So covetousness is desire and strong desire, inordinate desire, meaning desire that is not ordered, it's not regulated, it's over the top, right? It's one thing to have desire for something. It's another to have an inordinate desire where you just, it's all you think about. You can't not have this thing. You must have it. That is covetousness. Excessive desire. And covetousness is the driving force behind taking on debt. It goes like this. A man has a strong desire for something that he cannot afford. Maybe it's a car. Maybe it's a house. Maybe it's clothing. Maybe it's furniture. Maybe it's whatever it is. A four-wheeler. A boat. Right? You name it, whatever. He's got this strong desire for something that he can't afford. And he can't afford it because he doesn't have the cash to pay for it. Right? You always want to remember that. I know I've said this and I want to drive it home. Always remember, if you don't have the cash to pay for something, you can't afford it. Period. You can't say, oh, I can afford this because I can afford the monthly payment. No, you can't. You can't afford it if you can't pay for it. If you don't have the cash, you can't afford it. By definition. And oftentimes, even when you do have the cash to pay for something, you still can't afford it because you're using money that should be laid up for the future to fulfill the inordinate desire of the present. Did you get that? Even if you do have the money for something, I mean, let's say your entire retirement savings is $10,000 and you've just got to have this $10,000 boat. You think, I can afford it. I've got the $10,000. I can buy the boat. No, you can't. That's your whole retirement. You've got nothing to live off of, right? So even if you do have the cash, you can't afford it unless you've taken care of everything else in your life, including your future. And then and only then can you afford it. Once you've taken care of everything else, that's the only time you buy this junk you don't need. It's fine to buy junk you don't need when you've taken care of everything else, including your retirement and giving and all that other stuff. Then spend until your heart's content. Blow as much money as you want, having fun and buying junk you don't need when you've taken care of everything else that needs taken care of that we've looked at in this series. I'm not opposed to spending money when you do it right. There's so many things out there that are lawful if you do them right. Right? Marriage is great if you do it right. It can be a horrible thing if you do it wrong, right? Buying a house is great if you can afford it. It's a horrible thing if you can't. You're going to be house poor. That house is going to be a big ball and chain wrapped around your neck, right? A car is great if you can afford it. It's not if you can't, right? There's so many things that are great. They're really nice in their place. But if you do them wrong, they're not great. So getting back to this guy here that wants this thing so badly, but he can't afford it. So instead of waiting and denying his desires, he just takes out a loan for the thing, right? That's called covetousness. I want it. I can't afford it. I want it so badly. I'm just going to take out a loan. Covetousness. But the Bible teaches, and we all ought to remember this, we ought to memorize this verse. It's so important. The Bible teaches that a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things that he possesseth. Let's look at Luke 12 and verse 15. Remember this. The next time you're so tempted, you just have this thing that's eating you up inside that you want this thing so bad. Remember this, that your life does not consist of things. Luke 12 and verse 15. And he said unto them, these are the words of our Lord, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. But you know what? There are a lot of people's lives in this country that are completely opposite of that verse. Their lives do consist of the abundance of the things that they possess. That is what their lives are about. So many people in our hyper-consumerist America are just the opposite of that. Their lives consist of all the stuff that they have, and they just want more and more and more. That's why we have record credit card debt. Over $1 trillion of credit card debt. People's lives consist in the abundance of the things that they possess. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. Most of the things that people go into debt for are things they don't need, as I mentioned before. Most of the things. And as I said before, if a man does go into debt for things that he does need, like putting groceries or clothes on a credit card, if he does that, it's because he previously spent his money on things he didn't need. That's why. And Warren Buffett said the following, if you buy things you don't need, you will soon sell things you need. He's like a centibillionaire, over $100 billion, so he might know a thing or two about money. And then let's talk about how to get out of debt, except I'm not actually going to talk about it. I'm just going to refer to later in the study. When we get to the section on Pastor Wagner's Practical Tips on Money Management and to the section on Dave Ramsey's 7 Baby Steps to Get Out of Debt and Become Wealthy, we're going to learn how to get out of debt as quickly as possible. And I will say nothing more than you just do it with what Ramsey calls the debt snowball, and you list out your debts, smallest to largest, and you attack the smallest with a vengeance, make minimum payments on the rest. And as soon as you pay off the one, all the money goes on the next one, and you just keep doing that until they're all gone. But I'll get into more detail about that later. But getting out of debt should be very high on a Christian's priority list. All right, I think we have some time. Let's look at gambling. Yeah, I haven't even been going an hour yet. So, gambling. Gambling is a foolish way to spend money. Not smart. Sadly, it's not just wealthy people that go to Vegas and blow money at the tables. You know that most of the people that buy lottery tickets are poor people. Lottery tickets are a tax on the poor. The state sells them and makes money on them, makes money off the backs of poor people. It's pretty pathetic. It's a foolish way to spend money. The odds are that you're going to lose. The house always wins in the end. When I was coming back yesterday, I think it was yesterday, I saw a billboard for a casino of some kind, and it said something like, winning happens here, or something. I'm thinking, yeah, you're absolutely right. Winning happens there. The house wins every time. Bunch of morons. Gambling is for people who have never taken a class on probability and statistics. If you have, you either won't gamble or you'll realize that you are blowing your money and you're just doing it to have a little bit of fun. If you want to blow a little bit of money just to have fun, that's all right. I mean, you can blow money on a latte too and have a little bit of enjoyment. You could blow money at a casino and have a little bit of enjoyment, I guess. I don't get enjoyment out of torching money personally, you know, and just giving it to some big corporation at a casino. But if that's your thing, you know, I'll talk about that in a minute. Now, if you win, the money was gotten by vanity, and it's going to soon be diminished anyway. If you win big, it's probably not going to be a blessing to you. Proverbs 13 and verse 11. I think we've looked at this verse already. Proverbs 13 and verse 11. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. So if you did happen to win big, like the lotto or at the tables or something, chances are it's not going to last. It only lasts when you work for it. And that's pretty much almost universally true. If you just look through the Bible, you'll see that gamblers are not really in good company. It's just not people you probably want to aspire to be, probably not people you want to hang around with, because they have a pretty bad reputation in the Bible. Let's look at Psalm 22 and verse 18. Psalm 22 and verse 18. I'm just going to give you a couple of verses here. This is a prophecy of our Lord's crucifixion. It says, they part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. They're gambling, casting lots, right? Taking a lot to see who's going to get it. Matthew 27 and verse 35 shows us that this is talking about our Lord Jesus when he was crucified. Matthew 27 and verse 35. And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet. They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. And then let me give you one more in the book of Joel, back in the Old Testament. Joel 3 and verse 3. Those people have some really loud music. Joel 3 and verse 3. And they have cast lots for my people, and have given a boy for an harlot, and sold a girl for wine, that they may might drink. So yeah, not exactly a good people to hang out with. Casting lots for my people, they're gambling, and giving a boy for a harlot and a girl for wine. I have Las Vegas written next to that verse. Now, I wouldn't say that gambling is a sin under all circumstances. I don't think I can't really prove that from the Bible. But gambling could be a sin if it's done in a casino or another place or other places where women are dressed immodestly or where sinful behavior is being indulged in, like drunkenness and prostitution and that kind of thing. And all that that kind of stuff happens at casinos. So it's not a good place to be. So it could be a sin in the sense of guilt by association, basically. I wouldn't say that gambling itself is necessarily a sin. I don't believe so anyway. But we want to be careful about this. We want to make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. When you go to some of these places, this is a dangerous place to be because you are associating yourself with sinners, generally speaking. Romans 13 and verse 14. Romans 13:14. But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. You go to the casino and they're handing out free drinks and that's what they do. Now ask yourself a question. Why, when I go to a restaurant, do I get charged $5 or $6 for a beer and $9 for a glass of wine, and I go to a casino and they give it to me for free? Why is that? Do they just really like me? Are they is this a philanthropic organization? They're trying to be charitable to people? No. What happens when you drink more than one drink or more than two? You drink to excess. What happens? You lose your inhibitions. You lose your rational thought, right? You lose your ability to make good decisions. And then what do? Start throwing more money on the table. Start gambling more, right? Make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. These are not good places to be. In 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 22, it tells us we should abstain from all appearance of evil. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 22. Abstain from all appearance of evil. So this verse teaches us that not only do we have to abstain from evil, but we have to abstain from the appearance of it. Imagine if somebody says, you know what, I'm just not making a lot of money right now, and I live in an expensive place, and it's hard for me to afford an apartment. I'm going to therefore get, this is a man, I'm going to get a female roommate, and we're just going to split the rent and just live together, you know, and we're not. There's nothing going on between us at all. We're not even friends. We're just roommates. You can't do that. That's not abstaining from all appearance of evil. Even if you're not doing anything, it appears that you are, and therefore it's evil. Right? So when you go into a casino and you're playing at the craps table or at the blackjack table or whatever, you have to ask yourself, does it appear to be evil? If somebody saw me doing this, would they assume that I'm doing evil? You got to think about that. Now, while gambling is not strictly forbidden in Scripture, Christians should be very cautious if they engage in it. And I'm going to give you some guidelines here. First of all, if you have an addictive personality, you got to be honest with yourself about this. If you have problems controlling desires for alcohol, tobacco, food, caffeine, exercise, and whatever else people get addicted to, there's various things. If you have an addictive personality, I would say don't gamble. Because gambling can be addictive. There's a thing out there called Gamblers Anonymous. It's a 12-step program, just like Alcoholics Anonymous. People, for whatever reason, get addicted to this, and they can't stop. It's as strong a pull on them as heroin is. They, no matter how much they try, no matter how much their family pleads with them, before you know it, they're back at the casino and they're blowing money again. And probably because, well, for one thing, they've done it so much, they've completely run themselves broke and they think, but if I can just hit the big one, if I can just one more time, if I just do it enough times, probability says I'm going to win eventually. Yeah, like one in a million or one in more than that. Right, and they just keep going back and keep betting, just thinking that eventually I'm going to be able to get myself out of this. And they get addicted. They ruin their lives and ruin their families. It doesn't even have to be at a casino. Online poker. People play online poker. People do online sports betting now and other types of betting online. You can run yourself broke doing that. So I recommend don't start. That's just a stupid waste of money. Why would you do that? Especially online stuff. What are you doing? Why would you do that? At least if you go to a casino, you get to go there and maybe have a free beer on the house or something and blow a little bit of money just for fun. If you sit there behind your computer and bet on horse races or football games or whatever, that's a stupid way to waste money, in my opinion anyway. All right, number two, second guideline, never gamble with any money that you need and you can't lose. So if you have blow money, Ramsey calls it this, blow money. you put in your budget blow money, and I've got whatever amount, I don't, but I'm just saying, if you had a certain amount every month of blow money, and you want to go to a casino, and you walk in there only with cash, and maybe it's 20 bucks or 50 bucks or whatever, then do that. Walk in there with that cash, leave your dumb credit cards and your debit card and every other card at home. And if you need to leave your credit card and debit card at home when you go to a casino, don't go to a casino, because that tells me you have no self-control. Don't even go. But anyway, the point is, if you can go there with your $50 in your pocket and say, I'm just going to have fun, I'm going to blow this money, I know I'm going to lose it, but I'm going to have fun doing it. Okay, whatever. Go ahead. I don't see a problem with that, necessarily. I think it's stupid, honestly, but, you know, I think a lot of things are stupid that are okay to do, so... just because I think it's stupid doesn't mean it's necessarily unlawful or wrong. If you play a slot machine or at a table or something, one of those other things, limit yourself, I already said this, to a small amount of money before you start. And when that money's gone, do not under any circumstances spend any more. I mean, I'm talking, if you spend that 50 bucks and you're like, oh, you know what, I'm just walking past this last slot machine, I want to throw a quarter in it. Don't do it. Like, your 50 bucks is gone, is gone, period. Got to put the kibosh on that. So if you're doing it for entertainment and not with hopes of making money, then it could be permissible if done in moderation and with great caution. And then lastly, I'd say do not gamble often. You know, if you want to go once a year and blow some money on, you know, on that kind of thing, okay. If you say, yeah, I just like going down to the casino every day and using a little blow money. Right, yeah, you're an addict, and you need help. So I'm going to call it quits for here, and then next Sunday we'll pick it up, and I'm going to talk about bankruptcy, which, like I said, if you don't heed my warning about gambling, your next step is going to be bankruptcy, and you certainly don't want that. So we'll pick it up next Sunday, and I thank you for your kind and patient attention.